Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Bloomington Normal Water Reclamation District will have to spend $160 million plus over the next couple decades. Homeowners and apartment owners in the Twin Cities will have to pay for it. Here's a talk with Water Reclamation District Director Randy Stein about what that money will buy and who it will benefit.
The states in the Mississippi watershed have been directed by the federal government to come up with a plan to treat nutrients, both nitrogen and phosphorus. In Illinois, there was a plan put together by the wastewater agencies, by the environmental groups, and by the Illinois EPA, a plan to reduce nitrogen and phosphorus that is discharged to the Mississippi River in Illinois. It has been determined that POTWs and point source discharges to the system, POTWs, publicly owned treatment works, will bear the burden of reducing the phosphorus loads to the receiving streams.
Is that fair, considering phosphorus also comes from farm runoff?
Well, the farm runoff is going to be targeted for nutrients, for nitrogen. Most of the nitrogen component of nutrients come from farming. About half of the phosphorus nutrient becomes from POTWs. The facilities that, like Binward, are going to be responsible for reducing their phosphorus discharge. Currently, a lot of plants don't have a limit, and we do not, but we discharge around 3 parts per million of phosphorus to the receiving streams. Our influent is 6, and we get it down to 3.
And what will it have to move to?
It appears, we haven't gotten our permit yet, but it appears it's going to be 0.3.
Well, how expensive is getting from 3 to 0.3?
That's another chapter, but it's scores of millions over a long period of time. Our construction phase apparently will be 10 to 12 years. The old 1928-29 plant does not have the ability to be modified to remove phosphorus. Does a very good job in ammonia and BOD, and it does it very economically. The plant, our plant 3, which is a newer design from 1976 and 1988, can be modified to remove phosphorus. But the largest of the plants, the plant number 1, is going to have to be completely overhauled.
And if we're talking scores of millions, so what, $100 million, where is that money going to come from?
Well, our estimates are, at this point in time, about $160 million. We will not raise property taxes, but it will come from user fees. Our user fees on single-family home is in the $12 to $15 a month range for the Bloomington Normal Water Reclamation District. But we don't have a firm number yet, but we intend on small increases over a 5 or 6 year period. A lot of that depends on a final number. We're in the middle of doing the basis of design for what that plant looks like, and we are going to utilize some of the older structures on the plant.
So what period of time do you have to pay for it? Because that will affect the bigness of a user fee increase per household that Normal and Bloomington are going to have to pass on.
So the magic
to residents.
The magic date appears to be 2035. We have not gotten our permit from the Illinois EPA. That's the thou shalt permit. But it appears like we will be 2035 on a deadline, construction starting in 2 to 3 years. So we'll have a long period of time for construction. Therefore, we're going to be accumulating debt for a number of years. We anticipate the Illinois EPA revolving loan program is going to fund this project.
So the cost of the money will be relatively low.
It'll be low. Currently, the rates are around 2% or less. There may be some loan forgiveness. We certainly are going to apply for that, but there's no guarantee that there will be a portion of that forgiven. But our rate structure will increase gradually to cover the loan costs. I might point out that the district currently has a loan for the Southeast plant, which was built in 2005, and debt on that and debt on our CSO project will retire in 2027. So the current debt load that serves those facilities will become available for the good chunk of the loan going forward. We're not going to take the entire large amount as new debt. We're going to have a substantial amount we're already debt serving.
As we've seen from the Trump administration recent actions regarding California and fuel, auto emissions some administrations may have a different take on the need for environmental regulation. Is there any chance those rules on phosphorus will go away?
It's very unlikely. The momentum behind this nutrient removal dates back several administrations to the 90s. So the momentum is quite substantial. There are a number of plants in northern Illinois that are either under construction or have performed their construction tasks to meet this new standard. The emphasis on who got the limits first were those facilities located on impaired streams. The system has filled it down to the rest of the 216 major treatment plants in Illinois, and now facilities as ourselves, which are not located on an impaired stream, are starting to see requirements in their permit. A couple other plants in the area, Springfield completed modification to one of their plants and a complete total rebuild to another one of their facilities. They have two facilities also. Peoria has done has performed a big modification to their facility. So the momentum behind this nutrient removal has been there.
And at this point,
and there's a need for it. Eventually, in order to meet the goals for nutrient removal, the vast majority of the 218 majors in Illinois will have to comply.
We've heard many, many stories about the dead spot in the Gulf of Mexico caused by Mississippi River contamination. Take us through just how bad phosphorus is as an emission.
Well, I believe phosphorus affects the algae growth more in freshwater than it does in saltwater, and nitrogen really affects the saltwater. I can't tell you at what point in time phosphorus is acceptable in the stream. That's up for a big debate. The receiving streams, some of them are shaded and don't permit algae growth because of the shade and because of certain conditions in the streams. The phosphorus accelerates the growth of algae, and algae is what the problem is in the rivers downstream and in the Gulf. The nutrients promote the algae growth, which consumes oxygen and causes oxygen depletion in the Gulf.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Randy Stein of the Bloomington Normal Water Reclamation District. When will the public know how much their residential pass-through is for a per-household fee per month?
I would say, and again, this is all based on when we receive our documents from IEPA and then can complete the basis of design for what the plant looks like. I would anticipate within the next 12 months we should have a firm handle on that, perhaps 6 months. We need to know what the target is before we complete the design. But it appears that our discharge limit for phosphorus will be 0.3.
What else does the public need to know to get ready for this? Are there things they can do to affect wastewater?
Well, in our community, the proper use of fertilizers on lawns would help, because a big portion of older Bloomington especially, runoff from those yards wind up in the sewer, and therefore we are treating a load of phosphorus. I would say the community, with our influent numbers of 5 to 6 milligrams per liter or parts per million, is relatively low compared to, let's say, a Decatur and even a Springfield.
Why is that then?
It's the nature of the industries in town. You know, Decatur's got ADM, and an awful lot of grain is brought into that facility all over the Midwest, and the discharge of phosphorus is quite high in that wastewater stream. And we're blessed with a receiving stream that's in really good shape here. Fertilizers, one. Years ago, phosphates were removed from detergents. That helps. There is little on the domestic side that can influence the phosphorus discharge into the plant. It's more industrial, and stormwater can help, but we have a goal that's going to be fairly easily attainable. Technically can be done. It's going to be more complex than what we do currently. The operation of a wastewater treatment is more technically demanding than a lot of people think. It's a delicate balance, and it becomes more delicate with the phosphorus removal.
Will it require longer treatment times and a larger storage or a bigger field of sunlight exposure or something?
Well, when the plants were built in the 20s and right on up through the 80s, dissolved oxygen in our treatment process was a good thing. The more oxygen in that process, the more aerobic it becomes, and the bacteria that we promote really like that. So for treatment of BOD and ammonia, we wanted oxygen. But in order to remove phosphorus, at some point in time, we have to starve our bugs for oxygen. In order for them to survive, they look into the chemical availability of oxygen, and that's where phosphorus is released as they look inside for chemical sources of oxygen. So at some point in time, we have to maintain a delicate balance between an aerobic and anoxic condition in the tanks, and this becomes more difficult. Detention time will not change much. The volume of storage will be slightly different, but not a major factor. It's an awful lot of instrumentation. The equipment that we will use to provide the oxygen levels or lack of in the treatment system gets to be very delicate. The cruise control on your automobile can regulate an automobile to 1 mile an hour. If you set it at 55, it'll stay at 55 or 56 or 57. Well, when it comes to the dissolved oxygen levels, we are going to be very careful in much finer regulation. So we would have to make a cruise control for an automobile to regulate the speed in tenths of miles an hour. We have to provide enough oxygen to keep the bacteria alive, but at some point in time, we have to stress them.
Randy Stein is the longtime head of the Bloomington Normal Water Reclamation District, which treats 30 million gallons of water per day before releasing it downstream. The district has just celebrated its first century of operation. Before water treatment began, all sewage, industrial effluent, and slaughterhouse offal went into Sugar Creek.
Support for WGLT comes from Westminster Village, a locally owned and operated not-for-profit for over 40 years and now expanding the campus in Bloomington. New Westminster Village assisted living and memory support facilities currently under construction. Details at westminstervillageinc.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, Eric Stock reports on a Bloomington architect just named Architect of the Illinois State Capitol. A big policy choice is coming to a head soon in the Illinois State Capitol, whether to consolidate the assets of Illinois' public pension funds. The Illinois Politics Roundtable takes a deep dive into that topic. IPR Statehouse editor Brian Mackey moderates the panel with analyst Charlie Wheeler, Greg Hines, who covers politics for Crane Chicago Business, and Amanda Cass of the Government and Finance Research Center. Cass says there are hundreds of pension funds in the state.
Illinois is unique in that there are over 600 individual pension funds for police officers and firefighters, and they're kind of referred to as the public safety funds. And in general, most of the public safety funds are pretty underfunded, and to shore up the finances, municipalities' contributions into the funds are having to increase over time, creating some fiscal pressure for municipalities. So a task force was put together by Governor Pritzker to look at consolidating the funds. So instead of having 600 plus individual funds, consolidating them, and whether or not consolidation would generate some savings and help boost the finances of the pension systems.
You asked the question in your analysis of this. I'll put it to you directly. Is this a good idea?
One, it's hard to know whether it's a good or bad idea without seeing a detailed plan. Mm-hmm. So the task force report had two general recommendations. One is consolidating the assets of the public safety funds. The idea is the assets would be combined and pooled together for investment purposes, but the individual funds would kind of still remain in terms of determining things like disability issues and an overall accounting of their assets and liabilities. So it's not full consolidation. And then the second recommendation was to address an issue with the second reduced benefit tier and increasing the benefits. I think in general, both of those proposals could be really good policy, but the devil's always in the details. So I really want to see the legislation to kind of weigh in whether or not it's prudent.
Yeah, and Greg, you wrote about this idea of the tier two fix or change. This is a problem that goes beyond these local pension funds potentially, though, right?
Yeah, it is. One of the few things the state has gotten right in the last three or four decades on pensions is in 2011, we passed a new pension plan that affected all new employees that sharply reduced their benefits and forced them to pay more. But there's been concern ever since, and people have talked about this privately, but it's the first time I've ever really seen it emerge in public, that the benefits that are being offered are so small that we're violating federal law, because right now a lot of public employees don't pay into Social Security, they pay into these public plans, but in exchange, the public plans have to give them at least what Social Security would. Well, there's some reason now to think that the benefits under Tier 2 are so cheap that they're not. So that means we're going to have to go back and revisit a lot of these plans and put some more money in. Now, the governor's task force concluded that it would cost up to $90 million over some years to shore up these local police and fire pension funds that they want to consolidate the investment for. But there's some other big funds that would be affected, most notably TRS, the statewide teachers retirement system that pays for all teachers outside of Chicago and increasingly contributes to Chicago. A lot of teachers don't qualify for Social Security. They've only put it into this fund. Well, if they have to go back and sweeten those benefits, you're talking about some big money here, potentially. I mean, I haven't done an actuarial study, and I'm not aware that anybody else has, but I could easily see it running into the hundreds of millions of dollars, which constitutes a little more bad news on the pension front for a state that needs anything but.
The problem is that if we don't do it, we're going to face the penalties from the Social Security. And the reason I think that the state prefers not to have, well, like state university employees, teachers, a few state employees in Social Security is because the state can skip payments into the teacher's retirement system or the state university retirement system, but you can't skip the payments to Social Security or you go to jail.
And Amanda, local governments don't have that option, right, of just skipping payments. And if there's no action here, if there's no legislation to follow up on this suggestion, what are the consequences for municipalities that have these pension funds?
State law dictates what municipalities are supposed to put into the local public safety funds each year. And until fairly recently, though, there was nothing that enforced those payments. So municipalities could kind of just short their pension systems without real repercussion, and they did. But starting in 2016, if the municipality shorts the pension system, the local pension board can request the state comptroller to intercept revenue and redirect it to the pension fund instead to make up for that shortfall. We've seen that action get triggered in a few places, most recently East St. Louis. And the places where it has been triggered are communities that really have already existing fiscal issues and limited fiscal capacity. So they're not in a position to make the pension payments and kind of meet their operations without significantly cutting services. So I think consolidation is not going to resolve that problem completely. It's not going to resolve the fiscal pressure of pension contributions, especially for communities with little fiscal capacity. I think it will possibly create some savings and help the situation a little bit, but I don't, whether or not consolidation happens, it's not going to resolve the issue completely.
Didn't St. Louis lay off a bunch of firefighters just the other day?
They did, and it's a similar, so the East St. Louis story is a bit similar to what happened in the city of Harvey, of the pension systems, and Harvey requested the intercept, and in response to having state sharing revenue intercepted, the city laid off a large portion of its workforce, including police officers and firefighters. And it's notable because for Harvey, the state sharing revenue was something like 25% of its operating budget. You know, so yeah, think about suddenly having a quarter of your budget, a quarter of your income taken away, and how can you kind of keep operations going?
And for most cities, the major cost in their budget is personnel cost.
Yeah, Amanda's right here that this is going to help, but it's not going to solve the problem. What's ultimately going to solve the problem, if we can't reduce the benefits that the Supreme Court will let us, or if we can't declare bankruptcy somehow, which a lot of conservatives want to do, but appears not to be in the cards. The only way to deal with this is to pay up, and to pay up when you're supposed to, because when you postpone the payment, it gets more expensive. Illinois actually has one fund that works pretty well. It's the IMRF, the Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund, which covers non-public safety employees from most municipalities. But the way it works is they take a look at what the actuaries say every year, and if you're not paying enough, the municipality has to pay more. I mean, that way at least there's some discipline to ensure that you don't get into these terrible situations we're in now, where the debts are almost overwhelming. But that's not a feature of what's in Governor Pritzker's proposal, at least not now.
Greg Hines covers politics for Crane Chicago Business. He was part of this week's Illinois Politics Roundtable with Amanda Cass of the Government and Finance Research Center, analyst Charlie Wheeler, and the moderator, IPR State House editor Brian Mackey.
Follow GLT News at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. GLT's award-winning online presence brings you news when it happens, day and night, and on weekends. Join the community of users ready to discuss GLT's thoughtful, in-depth reporting and breaking news. Recognized by the Illinois Associated Press for best digital presence, this is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, I talk with Emmy Award-winning journalist Soledad O'Brien. The state of Illinois recently set aside $350 million for repairs and renovations to the state capitol and more than a dozen other state-owned buildings at the Capitol complex, and it put a Bloomington architect in charge of determining how that money gets spent. Andrea Agard has taken over the Illinois State Capitol architect job after working for Shive Hattery in Bloomington for nearly 15 years. Agard tells WGLT's Eric Stock her appreciation for the Capitol building dates back to her days growing up in southeastern Illinois.
Personally, you know, I was able to experience the Capitol when I was in junior high, going on a tour with my class. So it's one of those first field trips that I remember, and coming from a very rural area in Illinois, I thought, this is just amazing. What a cool building and structure, and to see the amount of power that happens within those walls was just, it just struck me at that time. And professionally, you know, for me to be a part of helping provide a space for the leaders of our community and our state to make those decisions that, you know, affect the population of Illinois, you know, for me to help provide a space that is comfortable for them, lets them efficiently do their job, that's what I'm looking forward to.
So it seems as though you have had a passion for architecture, particularly historic architecture, for quite some time.
Yes. Now, unfortunately, I was not able to work on any historic architecture while employed at Shive Hattery, but it is a passion of mine that I very much look forward to continuing to explore.
So the State Capitol building was built over two decades, starting just after the Civil War. So it's been around for a little while. How good a shape is the building today?
You know, with the maintenance the personnel that we have here locally and the mindfulness of those before me, it is actually in really good shape. You know, there was a renovation that was done several years ago, and, you know, focusing on portions of the Capitol to keep them up, you know, to start to be mindful to that ADA accessibility. And just to make sure that we're keeping up with the times of technology. You know, so that's one of the things that, you know, that we'll be focusing on in the future.
Alfred de Picanard is one of the architects of this building going back to the 19th century. He also helped design the Iowa State Capitol. How does the architecture of the State Capitol building and the design of it hold up today?
I mean, I think it is iconic. Obviously, you know, it's one of the tallest out there. Very similar to Iowa, as you referenced, and it's like nothing else. So, you know, I think it's an icon that several people, most people around the state, if they would see even just a graphical image of it, would be able to recognize. So, it's definitely a very very iconic structure to have.
And how difficult is that to preserve over all of these years?
Well, so, you know, there is always the challenge of having good documentation, especially if something that was built many years ago. And even though there was documentation, that doesn't always mean that the skilled labor followed that. So, you know, it's some type of a demo and investigation to figure out what is there, what we're going to be dealing with going forward. So it's not the easiest, but it's those types of projects that need to come before any major renovation to figure out what needs to happen.
I know you've only been on the job for a few days, but do you have a sense for how good that record keeping and that preservation has been over time?
Not yet. You know, that's one of the things that I'm going to look into in the next few weeks. I know that there are some out there. I'm just not sure of the quality that it's in.
And I guess as part of that history, we understand there were statues of women that Piquenard wanted in the building all the way back in the 1870s. They didn't want them at the time. I guess they thought they were too risque. The state of Iowa took them for their Capitol building, and they were the replicas of them were put back just a few years ago during the most recent renovation.
Correct. Correct, yes. And I believe they are not as risque, possibly been covered up a little bit.
That's part of the history, I guess, that maybe people aren't aware of, or that part of the story that you're looking to tell?
Yes. You know, it's in as I referenced before, it's these types of stories that are so cool, you know, to figure out that a statue had such an impact and, you know, how a neighboring state got the statue and we were able to replicate it and put it in place today, modify it a little bit to where it sits. Yeah, where it sits at the entrance of a stair today.
As we continue on Sound Ideas, I'm Eric Stock with Andrea Eggert, who has recently been named the new architect for the Illinois State Capitol building. I know the joke goes on sometimes that nothing goes on to the Capitol, but the State Capitol building has to be fully functional all the time, even while work is being done. How do you manage that?
Well, we are very strategic about relocating those who could be impacted, especially their job function being impacted, while any construction or remodeling is going on. We will evaluate those staff that are there, find them alternate locations until we can place them back to where they belong.
From what I understand, the position that you are occupying had been left vacant for a number of years. From what I gather, there wasn't as much work that needed to be done, and they are ramping this back up because renovations are necessary in the future. Since that office had been vacant for a couple of years, does that leave you with additional catching up to do?
Yeah, it really does. You know, I would say that this office does have staff that have been at the forefront trying to, you know, continue on with maintenance to make sure that everything is running as smoothly as possible. But with the budget that was just recently released, there are more things that we're now able to do to continue to preserve the structures. So I would say, yes, I'm coming in to some work. But there are people here who have done an awesome job keeping up with things in the absence of actually having a licensed architect in this position.
And we know the state recently approved a capital bill that includes money for construction of various projects all across the state. But does the state have the money to do all the work that's needed at the state capitol?
You know, I have not been in the position long enough to really evaluate that yet. But that's something I hope to in the future.
And from what I understand, you're looking to finalize the master plan to study the short and long-term needs of the building. Can you give us sort of an overview of what that entails, how you go about that?
Sure. So, you know, it really is evaluating the life of the buildings that are currently here. How much does it cost to be able to bring some of those buildings up to a code standpoint, redo the heating and cooling systems, and just figuring out if it's in best interest of state dollars to rehab that building and preserve it or potentially replace it with something that would still serve those who use it on a daily basis but be at a lower cost. Now, obviously, you know, any historic buildings, that's completely different because those we have to preserve, so we do about whatever is needed to preserve those.
That was State Capitol architect Andrea Eggert with WGLT's Eric Stock. You can see some of Eggert's architectural design work at Advocate Bromen Medical Center, State Farm, Miller Park Zoo, and other places throughout the Midwest. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a new report out at the University of Illinois looks at how to crack the Me Too problem in higher ed institutions. Emmy Award-winning journalist Soledad O'Brien calls herself a champion of diversity who gives voice to the underserved and disenfranchised. She is likely best known for work on CNN, where she spent months covering the devastation left by Hurricane Katrina. O'Brien will be the keynote speaker at Illinois State University's Latino Cultural Dinner at Bone Student Center November 4th. O'Brien tells WGLT's Eric Stock, covering the Katrina catastrophe and its aftermath became a touchstone moment that shaped her career as a documentary producer and host.
I don't think I really thought about how journalism could help move the needle on stories until I started covering Hurricane Katrina. You know, I thought of myself as a reporter. I go out and I tell stories. But in terms of journalism being leveraged to bring attention of the world to a breaking news story, I think I really began to understand the actual potential power of that during Hurricane Katrina, that, you know, everybody's watching and they weren't there. And you had to be able to tell stories of people who really had no voice. I mean, literally had no voice at all. And then I think that's when I figured out that there was just a lot of power in that.
Where do you feel the media goes wrong when reporting on issues of diversity?
Oh, my God. How much time do we have in this? because, I'm sort of kind of being joking-ish. I think the media goes wrong in reporting on diversity in many ways. But probably the biggest way is the point of view is from a white perspective, right? So, for example, a couple of interesting stories. I think we heard about Ellen saying that, you know, she's friends with George W. Bush. Totally fine. She's certainly a grown person, can do whatever she wants. But the discussion really stopped explaining why some people might find that disagreeable, right? It was sort of like a lot of the media was like, see, this is a good example versus here's why some people have a problem with that, right? So they're the perspective. And for me, I mean, people I knew who lost people in New Orleans felt like when you give your platform to someone who you personally hold responsible for something very, very bad that happened. So there are people in Iraq who would say, like, I'm not sure how I feel about this. People in Katrina, a lot of people, the soldiers, people who lost loved ones in the war. You know, this idea that their point of view was kind of irrelevant because, hey, she wants to do a selfie with the former president. Just not having that voice was problematic to me.
As we continue on Sound Ideas, I'm Eric Stock with Soledad O'Brien, who you may know best as a former anchor on CNN, an Emmy-winning journalist, news anchor, and she will be headlining Illinois State University's Latino Cultural Dinner on November 4th at the Brown Ballroom of Bone Student Center. And Soledad, as a child of immigrants, your mother from Cuba, your father from Australia, I understand you lost both of your parents this year. How did your upbringing as a family of immigrants shape your view of the immigration problem we have in the U.S. today?
Yeah, that's a really good question because I think we've never really had very non-charged conversations around immigration. I think at the beginning when I was growing up, my mother used to always say, you know, don't let anybody tell you you're not Latino, which is in a community where there's no Latinos, it's such a weird thing to tell a kid. I used to think my mother was 100% insane because there was no one who was saying, like, you're not Latino. If anything, the opposite was true. And it wasn't until I was in my 40s, actually, that I began to understand her point, which was don't let people define you and your value because of what their perception is of you. And by the way, my family is an exact representation of how it works. The first generation, you and I have people in the family, grandmother never learned any English. My mom did when she came. I obviously learned English, but my Spanish was pretty good. But my kids really struggle, right? Because that's the story. They lose the language, and it's very frustrating. It's very difficult. So usually by the next generation, everybody's like, no, my kid's going to learn the language of their great-grandparents. But this idea that somehow immigrants come and they don't assimilate, it's just not true. And when you have someone who's well-respected spewing something that is just factually untrue, as if somehow immigrants don't want to embrace all the opportunities here, And also don't help create a new definition of what it means to be an American. I think that's malicious, frankly.
Well, Soledad is the host of a news magazine on Sunday mornings called Matter of Fact. This is at a time when most of the political shows go to talking heads, the surrogates, two surrogates on opposite sides of an issue. These programs are ever present on cable news, of course, including CNN, where you used to work. You seem to feel these programs are not particularly illuminating. What do you feel the purpose of these are?
They're done because you want the sense of urgency. Listen, let me tell you something for anybody who's wondering. Having been part of these, they're done so that it looks like there is urgency and that there's conflict, and we know conflict sells, right? So if you have people fighting, it feels urgent. It gets everybody riled up. But there is no, it's a cheap way to do it. It's inexpensive to have talking heads who are basically paid over a year to be contributors to the network. What's much more expensive is to go out in the field and explain things. And so we try on our show, matter of fact, to go into the field and tell stories about what's happening. And you find when you tell stories about people, everything becomes less about, well, he's a Republican and he is a Democrat. Even though we do a political show, it's much more around policy. Why is there a housing crisis? How should people who are unable to get jobs figure out the change in the economy? Things like that, where it doesn't break down into Democrats and Republicans because everybody's affected. It's a policy conversation. And we have found that far more meaningful and far more valuable than just Bob's on the left, Sue's on the right, and now they're going to scream at each other for the next 10 minutes. Nobody likes that. I know people think it's a winning formula for ratings. It really is not. It does not win.
As we continue on Sound Ideas with Soledad O'Brien, who is coming to Illinois State University for the Latino Cultural Dinner on November 4th, confidence in journalism is starting to rebound after bottoming out in 2016, but it's still lower than it was back in the 80s and 90s, like a lot of American institutions. How would you describe the state of American media now?
You know, I think the definition is shifting, and we're trying to figure it out in a lot of ways. I think there's been a disinvestment in local news, which is really disappointing. And as much as people talk about the New York Times or ESPN or all the big cable networks, really the tragedy is in that small local newspapers are leaving communities because it's not, you know, financially viable. That is the disaster that's unfolding that very few people talk about. All the other stuff, listen, CNN's going to be just fine. The New York Times is going to be just fine. I think they make some very, very big tactical errors in how they think about the news, and hopefully they'll one day review what they've done right and what they've done wrong and make some changes. And I think the arguments and the debates are really, really healthy. What people don't talk about is small towns where you've never even heard of their paper, where their paper folds because there's just no financial support for it. That is truly a tragedy. No one's watching school board. No one's watching elected officials. No one's really watching, the police department. You know, that's a real tragedy.
Do you feel that trust in American media is starting to rebound, aside from what we hear often in some elements of the media that we know the term fake news, but do you feel that is changing in recent time?
Listen, I was at the airport not too long ago, and our flight was delayed. And they had a time up on the wall that said we were going to leave at, let's say, 8:35. But it was already 8:45, right? So clearly we were not leaving at 8:35. Everyone started shouting, fake news, fake news. So sometimes I think, you know, this concept of people not really having faith in the media is a little bit overstated. I think people like the media that they like, and they like the media when the media tells the stories that they like. It's more complicated than just yes, no. Listen, nobody is harsher on the New York Times than me, and no one retweets more of the great stories as the New York Times does than me. So does that mean I think there's fake news? I don't. I think that term is ridiculous because when everybody's shouting it at a clock, it's an indication like they jumped the shark a little bit. But I do think, you know, people can do better, and holding people accountable is important. And that's a much more important discussion.
Well, that dovetails into my next question about social media. And you are quite active on social media and often outspoken, often slamming President Trump, Republicans.
I will just call a liar a liar. And I do think I love social media because, you know, that sometimes the time is right. If someone is lying, I don't even care if they're a Republican, a Democrat, whoever. If you're lying, you're lying. And I think it's very refreshing to have someone who can just say, this statement is not true. This person is a liar. This person is a coward. The idea that, let's use Joni Ernst for a good example, who has served her country in the military, cannot answer the question about whether it's okay for a president to be involved in calling in a foreign country to be involved in another country's election, which, by the way, is in the Constitution. It's not that complicated. You know, it's just this idea. So let's call that out, because we understand what's going on. It's not that she doesn't know. It's not that she needs to, you know, more time to understand the issue. It's not that she hasn't read it, which is all the excuses that people use. It's that she doesn't want to answer a question that puts her directly in conflict with the president, because she's aware that the president will call her out and attack her. So she chooses a more cowardly option. That's just a fact. That is just a fact. So all the people who are talking about the Kurds today and saying we're going to pray for the Kurds, but who at the same time have enabled a president to do these things, that is hypocritical. And they are cowardly. And I think people need to be able to understand that. That's not, you know, some kind of going out on a limb. That's just a fact. We've opened up a group of people to be massacred. And there are people who have done it, who have their fingers on it, and everyone should know.
Do you feel, though, that that kind of language from coming from a journalist perspective may cause some to question objectivity?
I think there's a level of accuracy and truth. I think people should question journalists who do headlines where they say, the president says the sky is green, or the president, you know, something that is clearly a lie. I'm constantly pushing back on that, right? The sky is not green. We're not going to pretend to put that on social media for clicks when we all know the sky is not green. That is a lie. And framing things that are purely and overtly and obviously lies, the job of journalism is not to say, well, he says this, but she says that. It's actually to say, these things are true and these things are not true. And here is context. On our show, we're very clear about context. We want people to understand the why behind what's happening. On social media, which is my opinion, essentially, it's all about telling people, like, you need to understand that some of these things are not true. People are doing these things for a reason. But I will never, I don't care the political background of a person, I will never, ever, ever retweet something that is just overtly a lie because I want to get clicks, or because so-and-so said it, when we all know it's a lie. Context matters. And I think an area where journalists have really failed is to just keep repeating what the president has said when they know in that particular thing it's a lie, it's untrue.
That was journalist Soledad O'Brien with WGLT's Eric Stock. O'Brien and her husband run the Pow Herful Foundation that mentors women to help send them to college. The foundation has raised over $5 million since 2006. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign has released a much-anticipated report with recommendations to improve the handling of sexual harassment cases involving faculty. But as Rachel Otwell reports, change is not inevitable, and students still want buy-in.
My copy, because it might just...
Robin Carr, law and philosophy professor at UIUC, is sitting in his office flipping through the 127-page report the committee he headed put together.
All of this has been a cultural and environmental learning situation where people have begun to understand better the full nature of the harms.
Recommendations include expanding the definition of sexual harassment beyond the campus's current standard, hiring more confidential advisors to advocate for victims, and asking candidates for university jobs to waive confidentiality of disciplinary records. There are various avenues for approval, but whether the university's Board of Trustees will embrace change remains to be seen.
The last statutory changes that were approved by the board were in 2013. So it happens very rarely.
The hurdles to reducing sexual harassment in higher ed were on display at a recent summit hosted at UIUC. Panelists noted that many people never report incidents to Title IX offices, which are responsible for investigating sexual misconduct complaints. They also raised concerns about how effective Title IX training is and the need to intervene earlier to stop bullying or other problematic behavior.
We need to focus less on the policies and more on the conduct.
That's Christina Larson, an attorney who represents targets of sexual abuse and a panelist at the summit. Larson says in university settings, administrators don't have the same amount of power as they do in the corporate world, and colleagues often have as much power as administrators to intervene.
It doesn't matter whether it's illegal or not. What's ethical? What's appropriate?
A university spokesperson declined to speculate on when the reforms would be adopted or how much they could cost, but says the institution is committed to building a safer community. Here's Chancellor Robert Jones.
It was critically important that we work very hard and diligently to create a set of policies and practices that would really help us drive home the core message of intolerance of sexual harassment.
Jones says he and the provost are talking with stakeholders about revision and implementation. Calls for change at UIUC began a year ago at a Me Too forum at the College of Law. An audience member asked about reports of harassment by a law professor and what was being done to protect students. In August, an NPR Illinois and ProPublica investigation detailed allegations against several professors in recent years. It uncovered three previously unreported cases where professors were found in violation of university policy and were given periods of paid leave and the chance to resign.
Yeah, so during the consideration of new business, there's a period for technical...
A day after the Faculty Sexual Misconduct Committee's report came out, the university's Student Government Association convened. Sudar Shana Rao, a senior member who also heads the campus organization Students Against Sexual Assault, says student leaders wrote a letter asking to participate in the negotiations after reading the NPR Illinois ProPublica investigation.
So I think the next steps going forward are to keep this momentum going. And the student voice is so, so important. We have the most to lose if the administration or higher powers choose to abuse their power.
She still wants a seat at the table as talks of the committee's recommendations continue. I'm Rachel Otwell.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Every so often on our weekday podcast, The Leadoff, we like to bring you a story about someone who's making Bloomington Normal a better place, or in this case, a more delicious place. In this edition of More of That, Please, WGLT student reporter Tiffany Jackson introduces you to Alan Chambers.
When Alan Chambers was 17 years old, he took the wrong path and spent his teenage years in jail.
When you get your life taken away from you for a little bit, you have a more passion for life, more passionate about people as well.
After gaining a second chance at freedom, today he's made a comeback through entrepreneurship with a new business called A to Z's Catering and Parties. It's A to Z because Alan's business partner is Zach Shelburne, but that's not the only A to Z.
And we do food from apple to zucchini and everything in between is what we like to say.
Alan takes a lot of pride in his sauces, which he says are unique.
Sometimes you have to choose with your mouth and not your brain when you hear some of our sauces, like a spicy watermelon barbecue, a spicy lemonade. You know, we have things that trick your brain a little bit, like I just made a pear upside down cake. No one's ever done it before. I did. So, you know what I mean? We just like to take food to the next level, and that's what we mainly like to do.
As a child, Alan watched his mother cook. Whenever he get into trouble and face punishment, his mother took an unusual route to reward him for good behavior.
I was one of them kids that got in trouble a little bit, and my mom worked a lot, so gave me the opportunity to showcase my skills that way, and it was so good. She actually let me off punishment on certain occasions.
From there, his desire to pursue the culinary industry only grew. Aiming to pursue his passion after being released from behind bars, he reunited with his longtime friend, Zach, who loved food as much as he did. The two set out to launch the business a while after. Alan went through many hardships to overcome his past. He says he's faced barriers in registering for college classes, gaining the same opportunity as those who did not have a criminal history, and even being profiled.
Being a person of color, you definitely have to prove yourself better, especially in the line that I'm in. When you look at me, I'm a big black dude with dreads, goatee always, you know what I mean? Not always the most clean-shavenest person. So when you look at me, sometimes you read hoodlum first, but then you get to know me and know, oh, dude's a teddy bear.
Alan faced many challenges from potential investors. As he got discouraged, family members decided to help the two men bring their goals to fruition.
We had a lot of people back out on us on our business venture, so it led us to go a little harder and harder. But basically what took place is our parents got fed up, like, you know what, I'm tired of everybody backing out. I know what you guys can do. And they actually just put everything into us and tell us, and was like, let's see what's happening.
They opened the catering business in May of 2018. 17 months later, they've won numerous awards and have been hired all around town. Last fall, they were invited to cater for Naughty by Nature and Snoop Dogg when they were in Normal for a show. Those are the good days, but there are long days as well.
I just worked 18 days straight, no off day at all. And so it gets hard at times, but I know it's a bigger picture and out and at the end, so.
Alan says his ultimate goal for the business is to have a food truck alongside a social group for food lovers to network and convene. Till then, he plans to keep his reputation as one of the best chefs in town.
I challenge anybody to tell me that I'm wrong, that my food ain't the best, and especially in Bloomington Normal. And I'm not knocking other restaurants or anything, but proof is in the pudding.
A to Z's Catering and Parties is located on Linden Street in Bloomington, and it's not just a catering company. There are also carryout hours for the public, Thursday through Saturdays. I'm Tiffany Jackson.
We're always on the lookout for more community members to feature in our More of That, Please series. Send us your recommendations at news@wglt.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at wglt.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas, interviews, and stories. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 WGLT on WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.